a second the inside of the cabin was a furnace. A moment later, the flames snaked across the ground to where the tube was still spilling gas from the tank. There was another explosion as the gas tank blew up, rocking the pickup on its wheels. The rear tires caught fire, and flames flickered around the oily chassis. A disgusting smell filled the air, almost like roasting meat. Priest swallowed hard and stood farther back. After a few seconds, the blaze became less intense. The tires, the seats, and the body of Mario continued to burn slowly. Priest waited a couple of minutes, watching the flames. Then he ventured closer, trying to breathe shallowly to keep the stench out of his nose. He looked inside the cabin of the pickup. The corpse and the seating had congealed together into one vile black mass of ash and melted plastic. When it cooled down, the vehicle would be just another piece of junk that some kids had set fire to. He knew he had not got rid of all traces of Mario. A casual glance would reveal nothing, but if the cops ever examined the pickup, they would probably find Mario's belt buckle, the fillings from his teeth, and maybe his charred bones. Someday, Priest realized, Mario might come back to haunt him, but he had done all he could to conceal the evidence of his crime. Now he had to steal the seismic vibrator. He turned away from the burning body and started walking. At the commune in Silver River Valley, there was an inner group called the Rice Eaters. There were seven of them, the remnants of those who had survived the desperate winter of 1972-73, when they had been isolated by a blizzard and had eaten nothing but brown rice boiled in melted snow for three straight weeks. On the day the letter came, the Rice Eaters stayed up late in the evening, sitting in the cookhouse, drinking wine and smoking marijuana. Song, who had been a 15-year-old runaway in 1972, was playing an acoustic guitar, picking out a blues riff. Some of the group made guitars in the winter. They kept the ones they liked best, and Paul Beale took the rest to a shop in San Francisco, where they were sold for high prices. Star was singing along in a smoky, intimate contralto, making up words. "Ain't gonna ride that no-good train." She had the sexiest voice in the world, always did. Melanie sat with them, although she was not a rice-eater, because Priest did not care to throw her out, and the others did not challenge Priest's decisions. She was crying silently, big tears streaming down her face. She kept saying, "I only just found you." "We haven't given up," Priest told her. "There has to be a way to make the governor of California change his damn mind." Oak Tree, the carpenter, a muscular black man the same age as Priest, said in a musing tone, "You know, it ain't that hard to make a nuclear bomb." He had been in the Marines, but had deserted after killing an officer during a training exercise, and he had been here ever since. "I could do it in a day if I had some plutonium. We could blackmail the governor. If they don't do what we want, we threaten to blow Sacramento all to hell." "No," said Aneth. She was nursing a child. The boy was 3 years old. Priest thought it was time he was weaned, but Aneth felt he should be allowed to suckle as long as he wanted to. "You can't save the world with bombs." Star stopped singing. "We're not trying to save the world. I gave that up in 1969, after the world's press turned the hippie movement into a joke. All I want now is to save this, what we have here, our life, so our children can grow up in peace and love." Priest, who had already considered and rejected the idea of making a nuclear bomb, said, "It's getting the plutonium that's the hard part." Aneth detached the child from her breast and patted his back. "Forget it," she said. "I won't have anything to do with that stuff. It's deadly." Star began to sing again. "Train, train, no good train." Oak Tree persisted. "I could get a job in a nuclear power plant, figure out a way to beat their security system." Priest said, "They would ask you for your resume. And what would you say you had been doing for the last 25 years? Nuclear research at Berkeley?" "I'd say I've been living with a bunch of freaks, and now they need to blow up Sacramento, so I came here to get me some radio friggin' activity, man." The others laughed. Oak Tree sat back in his chair and began to harmonize with Star. "No, no, ain't gonna ride that no-good train." Priest frowned at the flippant air. He could not smile. His heart was full of rage. But he knew that inspired ideas sometimes came out of light-hearted discussions, so he let it run. Aneth kissed the top of her child's head and said, "We could kidnap someone." Priest said, "Who? The governor probably has 6 bodyguards." "What about his right-hand man? That guy Albert Honeymoon?" There was a murmur of support. They all hated Honeymoon. "Or the president of Coastal Electric?" Priest nodded. This could work. He knew about stuff like that. It was a long time since he had been on the streets, but he remembered the rules of a rumble. Plan carefully, look cool, shock the mark so badly he can hardly think, act fast and get the hell out. But something bothered him. "It's too, like, low profile," he said. "Say some big shot gets kidnapped. So what? If you're going to scare people, you can't pussyfoot around. You have to scare them shitless." He restrained himself from saying more. "When you've got a guy on his knees, crying and pissing his pants and pleading with you, begging you not to hurt him anymore, that's when you say what you want. And he's so grateful, he loves you for telling him what he has to do to make the pain stop." But that was the wrong kind of talk for someone like Aneth. At this point, Melanie spoke again. She was sitting on the floor with her back against Priest's chair. Aneth offered her the big joint that was going around. Melanie wiped her tears, took a long pull on the joint and passed it up to Priest, then blew out a cloud of smoke and said, "You know, there are 10 or 15 places in California where the faults in the Earth's crust are under such tremendous, like, pressure, that it would only take a teeny little nudge or something to make the tectonic plate slip, and then boom! It's like a giant slipping on a pebble. It's only a little pebble, but the giant is so big that his fall shakes the Earth." Oak Tree stopped singing long enough to say, "Melanie, baby, what the fuck you talking about?" "I'm talking about an earthquake," she said. Oak Tree laughed. "Ride, ride that no good train." Priest did not laugh. Something told him this was important. He spoke with quiet intensity. "What are you saying, Melanie?" "Forget kidnapping, forget nuclear bombs," she said. "Why don't we threaten the governor with an earthquake?" "No one can cause an earthquake," Priest said. "It would take such an enormous amount of energy to make the Earth move." "That's where you're wrong. It might take only a small amount of energy if the force was applied in just the right place." Oak Tree said, "How do you know all this stuff?" "I studied it. I have a master's in seismology. I should be teaching in a university now. But I married my professor, and that was the end of my career. I was turned down for a doctorate." Her tone was bitter. Priest had talked to her about this, and he knew she bore a deep grudge. Her husband had been on the university committee that turned her down. He had been obliged to withdraw from the meeting while her case was discussed, which seemed natural to Priest, but Melanie felt her husband should somehow have made sure of her success. Priest guessed that she had not been good enough to study at doctoral level, but she would believe anything rather than that. So he told her that the men on the committee were so terrified of her combination of beauty and brains that they conspired to bring her down. She loved him for letting her believe that. Melanie went on. "My husband, soon to be my ex-husband, developed the stress-trigger theory of earthquakes. At certain points along the fault line, sheer pressure builds up over the decades to a very high level. Then it takes only a relatively weak vibration in the Earth's crust to dislodge the plates, release all that accumulated energy, and cause an earthquake." Priest was captivated. He caught Star's eye. She nodded somberly. She believed in the unorthodox. It was an article of faith with her that the bizarre theory would turn out to be the truth, the unconventional way of life would be the happiest, and the madcap plan would succeed where sensible proposals foundered. Priest studied Melanie's face. She had an otherworldly air. Her pale skin, startling green eyes, and red hair made her look like a beautiful alien. The first words he had spoken to her had been, "Are you from Mars?" Did she know what she was talking about? She was stoned, but sometimes people had their most creative ideas while doping. He said, "If it's so easy, how come it hasn't already been done?" "Oh, I didn't say it would be easy. You'd have to be a seismologist to know exactly where the fault was under critical pressure." Priest's mind was racing now. When you were in real trouble, sometimes the way out was to do something so weird so totally unexpected that your enemy was paralyzed by surprise. He said to Melanie, "How would you cause a vibration in the Earth's crust?" "That would be the hard part," she said. "Ride, ride, ride. I'm going to ride that no-good train." Walking back to the town of Shiloh, Priest found himself thinking obsessively about the killing. The way the wrench had sunk into Mario's soft brains, the look on the man's face, the blood dripping into the footwell. This was no good. He had to stay calm and alert. He still did not have the seismic vibrator that was going to save the commune. Killing Mario had been the easy part, he told himself. Next, he had to pull the wool over Lenny's eyes. But how? He was jerked back to the immediate present by the sound of a car. It was coming from behind him, heading into town. In these parts, no one walked. Most people would assume his car had broken down. Some would stop and offer him a ride. Priest tried to think of a reason why he would be walking into town at 6:30 on Saturday morning. Nothing came. He tried to call on whatever god had inspired him with the idea of murdering Mario, but the gods were silent. There was nowhere he could be coming from within 50 miles, except for the one place he could not speak of, the dump where Mario's ashes lay on the seat of his burned-out pickup. The car slowed as it came nearer. Priest resisted the temptation to pull his hat down over his eyes. "What have I been doing? I went out into the desert to observe nature. Yeah, sagebrush and rattlesnakes. My car broke down." "Where? I didn't see it." "I went to take a leak." "This far?" Although the morning air was cool, he began to perspire. The car passed him slowly. It was a late-model Dodge Neon with a metallic green paint job and Texas plates. There was one person inside, a man. He could see the driver examining him in the mirror, checking him out. Could be an off-duty cop. Panic filled him, and he had to fight the impulse to turn and run. The car stopped and reversed. The man lowered the near-side window. He was a young Asian man in a business suit. He said, "Hey, buddy, want a ride?" "What am I going to say? No thanks, I just love to walk." "I'm a little dusty," Priest said, looking down at his jeans. "I fell on my ass trying to kill a man." "Who isn't in these parts?" Priest got in the car. His hands were shaking. He fastened his seatbelt just to have something to do to disguise his anxiety. As the car pulled away, the driver said, "What the heck you doing walking out here?" "I just murdered my friend Mario with a Stilson wrench." At the last second, Priest thought of a story. "I had a fight with my wife," he said. "I stopped the car and got out and walked away. I didn't expect her to just drive on." He thanked whatever gods had given him inspiration again. His hand stopped shaking. "Would that be a good-looking, dark-haired woman in a blue Honda that I passed 15 or 20 miles back?" "Jesus Christ, who are you, the memory man?" The guy smiled and said, "When you're crossing this desert, every car is interesting." "No, that ain't her," Priest said. "My wife's driving my goddamn pickup truck." "I didn't see a pickup." "Good, maybe she didn't go too far." "She's probably parked down a farm track, crying her eyes out, wishing she had you back." Priest grinned with relief. The guy had bought his story. The car reached the edge of town. "What about you?" Priest said. "How come you're up early on Saturday morning?" "I didn't fight with my wife. I'm going home to her. I live in Laredo. I travel in novelty ceramics. Decorative plates, figurines, signs saying baby's room, very attractive stuff." "Is that a fact?" "What a way to waste your life." "We sell them in drugstores, mostly." The drugstore in Shiloh won't be open yet." "Oh, I'm not working today anyway, but I might stop for breakfast. Got a recommendation?" Priest would have preferred the salesman to drive through town without stopping so that he would have no chance to mention the bearded guy he had picked up near the dump. But he was sure to see Lazy Susan's as he drove along Main Street, so there was no point in lying. "There's a diner." "How's the food?" "Grits are good. It's right after the stoplight. You can let me out there." A minute later, the car pulled into a slantwise slot outside Susan's. Priest thanked the novelty salesman and got out. "Enjoy your breakfast," he called as he walked away. "And don't get into conversation with anyone local, for Christ's sake."
This book is continued on Disc 2. Disc 2.
"Enjoy your breakfast," he called as he walked away. "And don't get into conversation with anyone local, for Christ's sake." A block from the diner was the local office of Ritken Seismex, the small seismic exploration firm he had been working for. The office was a large trailer in a vacant lot. Mario's seismic vibrator was parked in the lot alongside Lenny's cranberry red Pontiac Grand Am. Priest stopped and stared at the truck for a moment. It was a ten-wheeler with big off-road tires like dinosaur armor. Underneath a layer of Texas dirt, it was bright blue. He itched to jump in and drive it away. He looked at the mighty machinery on the back, the powerful engine and the massive steel plate, the tanks and hoses and valves and gauges. "I could have the thing started in a minute. No keys necessary." But if he stole it now, every highway patrolman in Texas would be looking for him within a few minutes. He had to be patient. "I'm going to make the earth shake, and no one is going to stop me." He went into the trailer. The office was busy. Two jug team supervisors stood over a computer as a color map of the area slowly emerged from the printer. Today they would collect their equipment from the field and begin to move it to Clovis. A surveyor was arguing on the phone in Spanish, and Lenny's secretary, Diana, was checking a list. Priest stepped through an open door into the inner office. Lenny was drinking coffee with a phone to his ear. His eyes were bloodshot and his face blotchy after last night's drinking. He acknowledged Priest with a barely perceptible nod. Priest stood by the door waiting for Lenny to finish. His heart was in his mouth. He knew roughly what he was going to say. But would Lenny take the bait? Everything depended on it. After a minute, Lenny hung up the phone and said, "Hey, Ricky, you seen Mario this morning?" His tone was annoyed. "He should have left here a half hour ago." "Yeah, I seen him," Priest said. "I hate to bring you bad news this friggin' early, but he's let you down." "What are you talking about?" Priest told the story that had come into his mind in a flash of inspiration just before he picked up the wrench and went after Mario. "He was missing his wife and kids so bad he got into his old pickup and left town." "Aw, shit, that's great. How did you find out?" "He passed me on the street early this morning, headed for El Paso." "Why the hell didn't he call me?" "Too embarrassed about letting you down." "Well, I just hope he keeps going across the border and doesn't stop until he drives into the goddamn ocean." Lenny rubbed his eyes with his knuckles. Priest began to improvise. "Listen, Lenny, he's got a young family. Don't be too hard on him." "Hard? Are you serious? He's history." "He really needs this job. And I need someone to drive his rig all the damn way to New Mexico." "He's saving up to buy a house with a pool." Lenny became sarcastic. "Knock it off, Ricky. You're making me cry." "Try this." Priest swallowed and tried to sound casual. "I'll drive the damn truck to Clovis if you promise to give Mario his job back." He held his breath. Lenny stared at Priest without saying anything. "Mario ain't a bad guy, you know that," Priest went on. "Don't gabble. You sound nervous. Try to seem relaxed." Lenny said, "You have a commercial driver's license, Class B?" "Since I was 21 years old." Priest took out his billfold, extracted the license, and tossed it on the desk. It was a forgery. Star had one just like it. Hers was a forgery, too. Paul Beale knew where to get such things. Lenny checked it, then looked up and said suspiciously, "So what are you after? I thought you didn't want to go to New Mexico." "Don't screw around, Lenny. Tell me yes or no." "Suddenly I could use another $500. "I don't know." "You son of a bitch, I killed a man for this. Come on." "Would you do it for 200? "Yes, thank you, thank you." He pretended to hesitate. 200 is low for 3 days' work. It's 2 days, maybe 2.5. I'll give you 250. Anything, just give me the keys. Listen, I'm going to do it anyway, whatever you pay me, because Mario's a nice kid and I want to help him. So just pay me whatever you genuinely think the job's worth. All right, you sly mother, 300. You got a deal. And I've got a seismic vibrator. Lenny said, hey, thanks for helping me out. I sure appreciate it. Priest tried not to beam triumphantly. You bet. Lenny opened a drawer, took out a sheet of paper, and tossed it over the desk. Just fill out this form for insurance. Priest froze. He could not read or write. He stared at the form in fear. Lenny said impatiently, come on, take it for Christ's sake. It ain't a rattlesnake. I can't understand it. I'm sorry. Those squiggles and lines on the paper just jump and dance, and I can't make them keep still. Lenny looked at the wall and spoke to an invisible audience. A minute ago, I would have swore the man was wide awake. Lator, pour doi cor. Priest reached out slowly and took the form. Lenny said, now what was so hard about that? Priest said, I was just thinking about Mario. Do you suppose he's okay? Forget him. Fill out the form and get going. I want to see that truck in Clovis. Yeah. Priest stood up. I'll do it outside. Right, let me get to my other 57 friggin' problems. Priest walked out of Lenny's room into the main office. You've had this scene 100 times before. Just calm down. You know how to deal with it. He stopped outside Lenny's door. Nobody noticed him. They were all busy. He looked at the form. The big letters stick up like trees among the bushes. If they're sticking down, you got the form upside down. He had the form upside down. He turned it around. Sometimes there was a big X, printed very heavy, or written in pencil or red ink, to show you where to put your name. But this form did not have that easy-to-spot mark. Priest could write his name, sort of. It took him a while, and he knew it was kind of a scrawl, but he could do it. However, he could not write anything else. As a kid, he was so smart he did not need to read and write. He could add up in his head faster than anyone, even though he could not read figures on paper. His memory was infallible. He could always get people to do what he wanted without writing anything down. In school, he managed to find ways to avoid reading aloud. When there was a writing assignment, he might get another kid to do it for him, but if that failed, he had 1,000 excuses, and the teachers eventually shrugged and said that if a child really did not want to work, they could not force him. He got a reputation for laziness, and when he saw a crisis approaching, he would play hooky. Later on, he had managed to run a thriving liquor wholesale business. He never wrote a letter, but did everything on the phone and in person. He kept dozens of phone numbers in his head until he could afford a secretary to place calls for him. He knew exactly how much money was in the till and how much in the bank. If a salesman presented him with an order form, he would say, I'll tell you what I need, and you fill out the form. He had an accountant and a lawyer to deal with the government. He had made $1 million at the age of 21. He had lost it all by the time he met Starr and joined the commune. Not because he was illiterate, but because he defrauded his customers and failed to pay his taxes and borrowed money from the mob. Getting an insurance form filled out had to be easy. He sat down in front of Lenny's secretary's desk and smiled at Diana. You look tired this morning, honey, he said. She sighed. She was a plump blonde in her 30s, married to a roustabout with 3 teenage kids. She was quick to rebuff crude advances from the men who came into the trailer, but Priest knew she was susceptible to polite charm.
Ricky, I got so much to do this morning, I wish I had 2 brains.
He put on a crestfallen look. That's bad news. I was going to ask you to help me with something. She hesitated, then smiled ruefully. What is it?
My handwriting's so poor. I wanted you to fill out this form for me. I sure hate to trouble you when you're so busy. Well, I'll make a deal with you.
She pointed to a neat stack of carefully labeled cardboard boxes up against the wall.
I'll help you with the form if you'll put all those files in the green Chevy Astro van outside.
You got it, Priest said gratefully. He gave her the form. She looked at it.
You gonna drive the seismic vibrator? Yeah, Mario got homesick and went to El Paso. She frowned. That's not like him. It sure ain't. I hope he's okay. She shrugged and picked up her pen. Now, first we need your full name and date and place of birth. Priest gave her the information and she filled out the blanks on the form. It was easy. Wyatt panicked. It was just that he had not expected the form. Lenny had surprised him, and for a moment he had given way to fear. He was experienced at concealing his disability. He even used libraries. That was how he had found out about seismic vibrators. He had gone to the Central Library on I Street in downtown Sacramento, a big, busy place where his face probably would not be remembered. At the reception desk, he had learned that science was up on the second floor. There, he had suffered a stab of anxiety when he had looked at the long aisles of bookshelves and the rows of people sitting at computer screens. Then he had caught the eye of a friendly-looking woman librarian about his own age. "I'm looking for information on seismic exploration," he had said with a warm smile. "Could you help me?" She had taken him to the right shelf, picked out a book, and, with a little encouragement, found the relevant chapter. "I'm interested in how they generate the shock waves," he had explained. "I wonder if this book has that information." She had leafed through the pages with him. "There seem to be three ways," she had said. "An underground explosion, a weight drop, or a seismic vibrator." "Seismic vibrator?" he had said, with just the hint of a twinkle in his eye. "What's that?" She had pointed to a photograph. Priest had stared, fascinated. The librarian had said, "It looks pretty much like a truck." To Priest, it had looked like a miracle. "Can I photocopy some of these pages?" he had asked. "Sure." If you were smart enough, there was always a way to get someone else to do the reading and writing. Diana finished the form, drew a big X next to a dotted line, handed the paper to him, and said, "You sign here." He took her pen and wrote laboriously. The R for Richard was like a showgirl with a big bust kicking out one leg. Then the G for Granger was like a billhook with a big round blade and a short handle. After RG, he just did a wavy line like a snake. It was not pretty, but people accepted it. A lot of folks signed their names with a scrawl, he had learned. Signatures did not have to be written clearly, thank God. This was why his forged license had to be in his own name. It was the only one he could write. He looked up. Diana was watching him curiously, surprised at how slowly he wrote. When she caught his eye, she reddened and looked away. He gave her back the form. "Thanks for your help, Diana. I sure appreciate it." "You're welcome. I'll get you the keys to the truck as soon as Lenny gets off the phone." The keys were kept in the boss's office. Priest remembered that he had promised to move the boxes for her. He picked one up and took it outside. The green van stood in the yard with its rear door open. He loaded the box and went back for another. Each time he came back in, he checked her desk. The form was still there, and no keys were visible. After he had loaded all the boxes, he sat in front of her again. She was on the phone, talking to someone about motel reservations in Clovis. Priest ground his teeth. He was almost there. He nearly had the keys in his hand, and he was listening to crap about motel rooms. He forced himself to sit still. At last, she hung up. "I'll ask Lenny for those keys," she said. She took the form into the inner office. A fat bulldozer driver called Chew came in. The trailer shook with the impact of his work boots on the floor. "Hey, Ricky," he said. "I didn't know you were married." He laughed. The other men in the office looked up, interested. "Shit, what's this?" Priest said. "Now, where'd you hear a thing like that?" "Saw you get out of a car outside Susan's a while back. Then I had breakfast with the salesman that gave you a ride." "Damn, what did he tell you?" Diana emerged from Lenny's office with a key ring in her hand. Priest wanted to snatch it from her, but he pretended to be more interested in talking to Chew. Chew went on, "You know, Susan's Western omelet is really something." He lifted his leg and farted, then looked up and saw the secretary standing in the doorway listening. "Excuse me, Diana. Anyhow, this youngster was saying how he picked you up out near the dump."
"Hell.
You were walking in the desert alone at 6:30 on account of how you quarreled with your wife and stopped the car and got out." Chu looked around the other men, making sure he had their attention. "Then she up and drove off and left you there." He grinned broadly, and the others laughed. Priest stood up. He did not want people remembering that he was out near the dump on the day Mario disappeared. He needed to kill this talk dead. He put on a hurt look. "Well, Chu, I'm going to tell you something. If I ever happen to learn anything about your private affairs, especially something a little embarrassing, I promise I won't shout about it all over the office. Now, what do you think of that?" Chu said, "Ain't no call to get sensitive." The other men looked shamefaced. No one wanted to talk about this anymore. There was an awkward silence. Priest did not want to exit in a bad atmosphere, so he said, "Hell, Chu, no hard feelings." Chu shrugged. "No offense intended, Ricky." The tension eased. Diana handed Priest the keys to the seismic vibrator. He closed his fist over the bunch. "Thank you," he said, trying to keep the elation out of his voice. He could hardly wait to get out of there and sit behind the wheel. "Bye, everyone. See you in New Mexico." "You drive safely now, you hear?" Diana said as he reached the door. "Oh, I'll do that," Priest replied. "You can count on it." He stepped outside. The sun was up and the day was getting warmer. He resisted the temptation to do a victory dance around the truck. He climbed in and turned over the engine. He checked the gauges. Mario must have filled the tank last night. The truck was ready for the road. He could not keep the grin off his face as he pulled out of the yard. He drove out of town, moving up through the gears, and headed north, following the route Star had taken in the Honda. As he approached the turnoff for the dump, he began to feel strange. He imagined Mario at the side of the road with gray brains seeping out of the hole in his head. It was a stupid, superstitious thought, but he could not shake it. His stomach churned. For a moment he felt weak, too weak to drive. Then he pulled himself together. Mario was not the first man he had killed. Jack Kastner had been a cop, and he had robbed Priest's mother. Priest's mother had been a whore. She had been only 13 years old when she gave birth to him. By the time Ricky was 15, she was working with 3 other women out of an apartment over a dirty bookstore on 7th Street in the Skid Row neighborhood of downtown Los Angeles. Jack Kastner was a vice squad detective who came once a month for his shakedown money. He usually took a free blowjob at the same time. One day he saw Priest's mother getting the bribe money out of the box in the back room. That night the vice squad raided the apartment and Kastner stole $1,500, which was a lot of money in the 60s. Priest's mother did not mind doing a few days in the slammer, but she was heartbroken to lose all the money she had saved. Kastner told the women that if they complained, he would slap them with drug trafficking charges, and they would all go down for a couple of years. Kastner thought he was in no danger from 3 B-girls and a kid. But the next evening, as he stood in the men's room of the Blue Light Bar on Broadway, pissing away a few beers, little Ricky Granger stuck a razor-sharp 6-inch knife in his back, easily slicing through the black mohair suit jacket and the white nylon shirt, and penetrating the kidney. Kastner was in so much pain he never got his hand on his gun. Ricky stabbed him several more times, quickly, as the cop lay on the wet concrete floor of the men's room, vomiting blood. Then he rinsed his blade under the tap and walked out. Looking back, Priest marveled at the cool assurance of his 15-year-old self. It had taken only 15 or 20 seconds, but during that time anyone might have stepped into the room. However, he had felt no fear, no shame, no guilt. But after that he had been afraid of the dark. He was not in the dark very much in those days. The lights usually stayed on all night in his mother's apartment. But sometimes he would wake up a little before dawn on a slow night, like a Monday, and find that everyone was asleep and the lights were out. And then he would be possessed by blind, irrational terror, and would blunder around the room, bumping into furry creatures and touching strange, clammy surfaces, until he found the light switch and sat on the edge of the bed, panting and perspiring, slowly recovering as he realized that the clammy surface was the mirror and the furry creature his fleece-lined jacket. He had been afraid of the dark until he found Star. He recalled a song that had been a hit the year he met her, and he began to sing, "Smoke on the water,
The band was Deep Purple, he recalled. Everyone was playing their album that summer. It was a good apocalyptic song to sing at the wheel of a seismic vibrator. Smoke on the water, a fire in the sky. He passed the entrance to the dump and drove on, heading north. "We'll do it tonight," Priest had said. "We'll tell the governor there'll be an earthquake 4 weeks from today." Starr was dubious. "We're not even sure this is possible. Maybe we should do everything else first, get all our ducks lined up in a row, then issue the ultimatum." "Hell no," Priest said. The suggestion angered him. He knew that the group had to be led. He needed to get them committed. They had to go out on a limb, take a risk, and feel there was no turning back. Otherwise, tomorrow they would think of reasons to get scared and back out. They were fired up now. The letter had arrived today, and they were all angry and desperate. Starr was grimly determined. Melanie was in a fury. Oak Tree was ready to declare war. Paul Beale was reverting to his street hoodlum type. Song had hardly spoken, but she was the helpless child of the group and would go along with the others. Only Aneth was opposed, and her opposition would be feeble because she was a weak person. She would be quick to raise objections, but she would back down even faster. Priest himself knew with cold certainty that if this place ceased to exist, his life would be over. Now Aneth said, "But an earthquake might kill people." Priest said, "I'll tell you how I figure this will pan out. I guess we'll have to cause a small, harmless tremor out in the desert somewhere, just to prove we can do what we say. Then, when we threaten a second earthquake, the governor will negotiate." Aneth turned her attention back to her child. Oak Tree said, "I'm with Priest. Do it tonight." Starr gave in. "How should we make the threat?" "An anonymous phone call or letter, I guess," Priest said. "But it has to be impossible to trace." Melanie said, "We could post it on an internet bulletin board. If we used my laptop and mobile phone, no one could possibly trace it." Priest had never seen a computer until Melanie arrived. He threw a questioning glance at Paul Beale, who knew all about such things. Paul nodded and said, "Good idea." "All right," Priest said. "Get your stuff." Melanie went off. "How will we sign the message?" Starr said. "We need a name." Song said, "Something that symbolizes a peace-loving group who have been driven to take extreme measures." "I know," Priest said. "We'll call ourselves the Hammer of Eden." It was just before midnight on the 1st of May. Priest became tense as he reached the outskirts of San Antonio. In the original plan, Mario would have driven the truck as far as the airport. But now Priest was alone as he entered the maze of freeways that encircled the city, and he began to sweat. There was no way he could read a map. When he had to drive an unfamiliar road, he always took Starr with him to navigate. She and the other rice-eaters knew he could not read. The last time he drove alone on strange roads had been in the late autumn of 1972, when he fled from Los Angeles and finished up, by accident, at the commune in Silver River Valley. He had not cared where he went then. In fact, he would have been happy to die. But now he wanted to live. Even road signs were difficult for him. If he stopped and concentrated for a while, he could tell the difference between east and west or north and south. Despite his remarkable ability to calculate in his head, he could not read numbers without staring hard and thinking long. With an effort, he could recognize signs for Route 10, the stick with a circle. But there was a lot of other stuff on road signs that meant nothing to him and confused the picture. He tried to stay calm, but it was difficult. He liked to be in control. He was maddened by the sense of helplessness and bewilderment that came over him when he lost his way. He knew by the sun which way was north. When he felt he might be going wrong, he pulled into the next gas station or shopping mall and asked for directions. He hated doing it, for people noticed the seismic vibrator. It was a big rig, and the machinery on the back looked kind of intriguing, and there was a danger he would be remembered, but he had to take the risk. And the directions were not always helpful. Gas station attendants would say things like, "Yeah, easy, just follow Corpus Christi Highway until you see a sign for Brooks Air Force Base." Priest just forced himself to remain calm, keep asking questions, and hide his frustration and anxiety. He played the part of a friendly but stupid truck driver, the kind of person who would be forgotten by the next day. And eventually he got out of San Antonio on the right road, sending up prayers of thanks to whatever gods might be listening. A few minutes later, passing through a small town, he was relieved to see the blue Honda parked at a McDonald's restaurant. He hugged Star gratefully. "What the hell happened?" she said worriedly. "I expected you a couple of hours ago." He decided not to tell her he had killed Mario. "I got lost in San Antonio," he said. "I was afraid of that. When I came through, I was surprised how complicated the freeway system was." "I guess it's not half as bad as San Francisco, but I know San Francisco." "Well, you're here now. Let's order coffee and get you calmed down." Priest bought a bean burger and got a free plastic clown, which he put carefully in his pocket for his 6-year-old son, Smiler. When they drove on, Star took the wheel of the truck. They planned to drive nonstop all the way to California. It would take at least 2 days and nights, maybe more. One would sleep while the other drove. They had some amphetamines to combat drowsiness. They left the Honda in the McDonald's lot. As they pulled away, Star handed Priest a paper bag, saying, "I got you a present." Inside was a pair of scissors and a battery-powered electric shaver. "Now you can get rid of that damn beard," she said. He grinned. He turned the rearview mirror toward himself and started to cut. His hair grew fast and thick, and the bushy beard and mustache had made him round-faced. Now his own face gradually reemerged. With the scissors, he trimmed the hair down to a stubble, then he used the shaver to finish the job. Finally, he took off his cowboy hat and undid his plate. He threw the hat out the window and looked at his reflection. His hair was pushed back from a high forehead and fell in waves around the gaunt face. He had a nose like a blade and hollow cheeks, but he had a sensual mouth. Many women had told him that. However, it was his eyes they usually talked about. They were dark brown, almost black, and people said they had a forceful staring quality that could be mesmerizing. Priest knew it was not the eyes themselves, but the intensity of the look that could captivate a woman. He gave her the feeling that he was concentrating powerfully on her and nothing else. He could do it to men, too. He practiced the look now in the mirror. "Handsome devil," Star said, laughing at him, but in a nice way, affectionate. "Smart, too," Priest said. "I guess you are. You got us this machine, anyway." Priest nodded. "And you ain't seen nothing yet." Chapter 2. In the federal building at 450 Golden Gate Avenue in San Francisco, early on Monday morning, FBI agent Judy Maddox sat in a courtroom on the 15th floor, waiting. The court was furnished in blonde wood. New courtrooms always were. They generally had no windows, so the architects tried to make them brighter by using light colors. That was her theory. She spent a lot of time waiting in courtrooms. Most law enforcement personnel did. She was worried. In court, she was often worried. Months of work, sometimes years, went into preparing a case, but there was no telling how it would go once it got to court. The defense might be inspired or incompetent, the judge a sharp-eyed sage or a senile old fool, the jury a group of intelligent, responsible citizens or a bunch of low-life jerks who ought to be behind bars themselves. 4 men were on trial today. John Parton, Ernest Taxman Diaz, Fung Lee, and Fung Ho. The Fung brothers were the big-time crooks, the other two their executives. In cooperation with the Hong Kong Triad, they had set up a network for laundering money from the Northern California dope industry. It had taken Judy a year to figure out how they were doing it, and another year to prove it. She had one big advantage when going after Asian crooks. She looked Oriental. Her father was a green-eyed Irishman, but she took more after her late mother, who had been Vietnamese. Judy was slender and dark-haired, with an upward slant to her eyes. The middle-aged Chinese gangsters she had been investigating had never suspected that this pretty little half-Asian girl was a hotshot FBI agent. She was working with an assistant U.S. attorney whom she knew unusually well. His name was Don Riley, and until a year ago they had been living together. He was her age, 36, and he was experienced, energetic, and as smart as a whip. She had thought they had a watertight case, but the accused men had hired the top criminal law firm in the city and put together a clever, vigorous defense. Their lawyers had undermined the credibility of witnesses who were, inevitably, from the criminal milieu themselves, and they had exploited the documentary evidence amassed by Judy to confuse and bewilder the jury. Now, neither Judy nor Don could guess which way it would go. Judy had a special reason to be worried about this case. Her immediate boss, the supervisor of the Asian Organized Crime Squad, was about to retire, and she had applied for the job. The overall head of the San Francisco office, the special agent in charge, or SAC, would support her application, she knew. But she had a rival, Marvin Hayes, another high-flying agent in her age group. And Marvin also had powerful support. His best friend was the assistant special agent in charge responsible for all the organized crime and white-collar crime squads. Promotions were granted by a career board, but the opinions of the SAC and ASACs carried a lot of weight. Right now, the contest between Judy and Marvin Hayes was close. She wanted that job. She wanted to rise far and fast in the FBI. She was a good agent. She would be an outstanding supervisor, and one of these days she would be the best SAC the Bureau had ever had. She was proud of the FBI, but she knew she could make it better. With faster introduction of new techniques like profiling through the use of streamlined management systems and, most of all, by getting rid of agents like Marvin Hayes. Hayes was the old-fashioned type of law enforcement officer, lazy, brutal, and unscrupulous. He had not put as many bad guys in jail as Judy, but he had made more high-profile arrests. He was good at insinuating himself into a glamorous investigation and quick to distance himself from a case that was going south. The SAC had hinted to Judy that she would get the job, rather than Marvin, if she won her case today. In court with Judy were most of the team on the Fung case. Her supervisor, the other agents who had worked with her, a linguist, the squad secretary, and two San Francisco Police Department detectives. To her surprise, neither the ASAC nor the SAC was there. This was a big case, and the result was important to both of them. She felt a twinge of unease. She wondered if something was going on at the office that she did not know about. She decided to step outside and call, but before she got to the door, the clerk of the court entered and announced that the jury was about to return. She sat down again. A moment later, Don came back in, smelling of cigarettes. He had started smoking again since they split. He gave her shoulder an encouraging squeeze. She smiled at him. He looked nice with his neat short haircut, dark blue suit, white button-down shirt, and dark red Armani tie. But there was no chemistry, no zing. She no longer wanted to muss his hair and undo his tie and slide her hand inside the white shirt. The defense lawyers returned, the accused men were walked into the dock, the jury entered, and at last the judge emerged from his chambers and took his seat. Judy crossed her fingers under the table. The clerk stood up. "Members of the jury, have you reached a verdict?" Absolute silence descended. Judy realized she was tapping her foot. She stopped. The foreman, a Chinese shopkeeper, stood up. Judy had spent many hours wondering whether he would sympathize with the accused because two of them were Chinese, or hate them for dishonoring the race. In a quiet voice, he said, "We have." "And how do you find the accused, guilty or not guilty?" "Guilty as charged." There was a second of silence as the news sank in. Behind her, Judy heard a groan from the dock. She resisted the impulse to whoop with joy. She looked at Don, who was smiling broadly at her. The expensive defense lawyers shuffled papers and avoided each other's eyes. Two reporters got up and left hastily, heading for the phones. The judge, a thin, sour-faced man of around 50, thanked the jury and adjourned the case for sentencing in a week's time. "I did it," Judy thought. "I won the case. I put the bad guys in jail, and my promotion is in the bag." Supervising Special Agent Judy Maddox, only 36, a rising star. "All stand," the clerk said. The judge went out. Don hugged Judy. "You did a great job," she told him. "Thanks." "You gave me a great case," he said. She could tell he wanted to kiss her, so she stepped back a pace. Well, we both did good, she said. She turned to her colleagues and went around them all, shaking hands and hugging and thanking them for their work. Then the defense lawyers came over. The senior of the two was David Fielding, a partner in the firm of Brooks Fielding. He was a distinguished-looking man of about 60. "Congratulations, Ms. Maddox, on a well-deserved win," he said. "Thank you," she said. "It was closer than I expected. I thought I had it buttoned up until you got started." He acknowledged the compliment with a tilt of his well-groomed head. "Your preparation was immaculate. Were you trained as a lawyer?"
"I went to Stanford Law School."
"I thought you must have a law degree. Well, if you ever get tired of the FBI, please come and see me. With my firm, you could be earning 3 times your present salary in less than a year." She was flattered, but she also felt condescended to, so her reply was sharp. "That's a nice offer, but I want to put bad guys in jail, not keep them out." "I admire your idealism," he said smoothly, and turned to speak to Don. Judy realized she had been waspish. It was a fault of hers, she knew. But what the hell, she did not want a job with Brooks Fielding. She picked up her briefcase. She was eager to share her victory with the SAC. The San Francisco field office of the FBI was in the same building as the court, on 2 lower floors. As she turned to leave, Don grabbed her arm. "Have dinner with me?" he said. "We ought to celebrate." She did not have a date.
"Sure.
I'll make a reservation and call you." As she left the room, she remembered the feeling she had had earlier, that he wanted to kiss her, and she wished she had invented an excuse. As she entered the lobby of the FBI office, she wondered again why the SAC and the ASAC had not come to court for the verdict. There was no sign of unusual activity here. The carpeted corridors were quiet. The robot mailman, a motorized cart, hummed from door to door on its predetermined route. For a law enforcement agency, they had fancy premises. The difference between the FBI and a police precinct house was like the difference between corporate headquarters and the factory floor. She headed for the SAC's office. Milton Lestrange had always had a soft spot for her. He had been an early supporter of women agents, who now numbered 10% of agents. Some SACs barked orders like army generals, but Milt was always calm and courteous. As soon as she entered his outer office, she knew something was wrong. His secretary had obviously been crying. Judy said, "Linda, are you okay?" The secretary, a middle-aged woman who was normally coldly efficient, burst into tears. Judy went to comfort her, but Linda waved her away and pointed to the door of the inner office. Judy went in. It was a large room, expensively furnished, with a big desk and a polished conference table. Sitting behind Lestrange's desk, with his jacket off and his tie loosened, was ASAC Brian Kincaid, a big, barrel-chested man with thick white hair. He looked up and said, "Come in, Judy." "What the hell's going on?" she said. "Where's Milt?" "I have bad news," he said, though he did not look too sad. "Milt is in the hospital. He's been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer."
"Oh, my God."
Judy sat down. Lestrange had gone to the hospital yesterday, for a routine checkup, he had said, but he must have known there was something wrong. Kincaid went on. "He'll be having an operation, some kind of intestinal bypass, and he won't be back here for a while at best."
Poor Milt.
Judy was shocked. He had seemed like a man at his peak, fit, vigorous, a good boss. Now he had been diagnosed with a deadly illness. She wanted to do something to comfort him, but she felt helpless.
"I guess Jessica's with him," she said.
Jessica was Milt's second wife. "Yes, and his brother's flying up from Los Angeles today. Here in the office..."
"What about his first wife?"
Kincaid looked irritated. "I don't know about her. I talked to Jessica."
"Someone should tell her. I'll see if I can get a number for her."
"Whatever." Kincaid was impatient to get off the personal stuff and talk about work. "Here in the office, there's some changes, inevitably. I've been made acting SAC in Milt's absence."
Judy's heart sank.
"Congratulations," she said, trying for a neutral tone. "I'm moving you to the domestic terrorism desk." At first, Judy was just puzzled.
"What for?"
"I think you'll do well there." He picked up the phone and spoke to Linda.
Ask Matt Peters to come in and see me right away. Peters was supervisor of the DT squad.
But I just won my case, Judy said indignantly. I put the Fung brothers in jail today.
Well done. That doesn't change my decision.
Wait a minute. You know I've applied for the job of supervisor in the Asian Organized Crime Squad. If I get moved off the squad now, it's going to look like I had some kind of problem.
I think you need to broaden your experience.
And I think you want Marvin to get the Asian desk.
You're right. I believe Marvin is the best person for that job.
What a jerk, Judy thought furiously. He gets made boss, and the first thing he does is use his new power to promote a buddy.
You can't do this, she said. We have equal employment opportunity rules.
Go ahead, make a complaint, Kincaid said. Marvin is better qualified than you.
I've put a hell of a lot more bad guys in jail.
Kincaid gave her a complacent smile and played his trump card. But he spent 2 years at headquarters in Washington. He was right, Judy thought despairingly. She had never worked at FBI headquarters, and although it was not an absolute requirement, headquarters experience was thought desirable in a supervisor. So there was no point in her making an equal employment opportunity complaint. Everyone knew she was the better agent, but Marvin looked better on paper. Judy fought back tears. She had worked her socks off for 2 years and scored a major victory against organized crime, and now she was being cheated of her reward by this creep.